Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
The Fast Track to Same-Sex Marriage. Hello again, I'm Orrin Alney, and this is Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. President Obama is just one supporter of gay rights who draws the line at same-sex marriage. Today, we'll talk about a movement with unexpected momentum and efforts to speed it up as well as slow it down. Also on Which Way L.A., the L.A. City Council is looking at major program cuts to avoid layoffs. What will that mean for the Ethics Commission and neighborhood councils, two civic watchdogs created by city voters? First, here's the news. We're in Alney back with Which Way L.A. on KCRW. The L.A. City budget is being cut, squeezed, and trimmed by the mayor and the city council. Are they taking the opportunity to reduce the power of two agencies created by voters to increase citizen participation and make sure elected officials observe campaign limits and regulations? Also tonight, what caused the Jesusita fire near Santa Barbara? Those stories at 7:30 tonight. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Last week, the Washington, D.C. City Council voted 12-1 to recognize same-sex marriages performed in other jurisdictions. The lone no vote came from a former civil rights leader who was called a bigot by a gay council colleague. A group of African-American ministers stormed the hallway outside, and police were called in to restore order. Reverend Derek McCoy is minister of the Hope Christian Church in nearby Beltsville, Maryland. He was part of that protest, and he also helped organize black ministers to support Proposition 8, last year's ban on same-sex marriage in California. Reverend McCoy, good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you as well.
Tell us what was going on with the city council in Washington, D.C.
Well, I think what you saw is, interesting enough, I mean, I've been called intolerant and a whole lot of names since beginning to voice my opinion on this issue, and I think you even saw Councilmember Catania show his thoughts to former Mayor Marion Barry and now council member by calling him a bigot. Now, I think the interesting thing, though, is that the council voted in a 12-1 decision. All this was is a marriage recognition bill saying that marriages performed in other states will be recognized in the District of Columbia. Of course, the purpose of it was to make sure that they recognize the same-sex marriages that are performed. Heterosexual marriages are really never in question. It's just making sure that what's happened already now in Massachusetts and Vermont and other states, that it's recognized in the District of Columbia. And I think it's a backdoor approach to getting same-sex marriage. The way they did the bill was kind of interesting because it was not agendized. And the other side, though, where you saw the outrage was probably because you had a 12-1 vote, Mayor Barry being the only one, or Councilmember Barry being the only person who opposed it. But that's nowhere near reflective, just almost as it is in Iowa. It's nowhere near reflective of the constituents of the state. And I think these lawmakers need to understand you have to reflect what they're put in office to reflect the constituents, not just to make arbitrary rules on what they feel personally. And I think they had broken some kind of deal, which I think was not right. And what you saw is the frustration of many members beginning to communicate their frustration on that issue.
Former Mayor Barry said that he's very much in favor of gay rights, but that his constituents are not in favor of gay marriage, most of them, of course, being African-American, a point he made very strongly. Reverend McCoy, do you object, and do other black leaders object, when the language of the civil rights movement is used to describe discrimination against gays and lesbians who want to get married?
Well, I think so, and it was interesting. I was looking at a 2004 Ebony magazine issue just recently, and they had several different African-American leaders that were speaking out on this issue. Reverend Walter Fauntleroy is one of them, which is an old former civil rights, well, not even former, but he's a civil rights leader and still representative in the city of Washington, D.C. today. And as you know, one of the first voices to represent the District of Columbia. I just spoke with him earlier today, ironically. And, he, again, restated his dramatic position that he does not feel that this is a civil rights issue, so to speak. He does believe that, and just like I believe, that everybody has a right as an American citizen. However, you cannot equate that struggle of civil rights time and that era with a class of people with immutable characteristics that had generational issues being brought from one country to another, and then we're having to go through to kind of claim our civil rights for just the rights of even being classified as a person, just a person, not just I want to get married, but as a person. The gay rights movement has nowhere near similarities to that issue at all. And I think a lot of ministers and leaders in the community take a wide offense to that issue. And it was even spoken about in that article that I was talking about. So I'm just one of the people that are representing. I don't think that's an equatable argument. I think what has happened, though, is that they have found, you know, in the current society, talking points and marketing is everything. And so I think they found a marketing message that appeals to many people. And it sounds great that we're all about equality, but really what it's about, it's really about the issue of their own feeling of acceptance. Because if it was just about equality, they would be satisfied with domestic partnerships and civil unions, but obviously that's not the case.
Why did you vote for, or support Proposition 8?
Well, I supported Proposition 8 because I felt that, one, even though the judges began to make their own decision and they kind of overturned the vote of millions of people in Proposition 22, as you saw in the actual constitutional amendment or the Proposition 8 issue, is that millions of people supported marriage being still being defined between a man and a woman, even in the liberal state of California. And I think for the most part, you got to understand that because we live in such a great place like America, we get the right to voice our opinion and make a statement. And I believe that marriage should continue to be defined between a man and a woman, and people can live as though they want to live. I just don't think they get the opportunity to redefine it for everybody else.
Again, Reverend Derek McCoy is a minister at the Hope Christian Church in Beltsville, Maryland. I want to introduce Mignon Moore, who is a sociology professor at UCLA, author of an upcoming book, Invisible Families, Gay Identities, Relationships, and Motherhood Among Black Women. Mignon Moore, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Give us a little background here on why it is that there is this distinction made, as we just heard Derek McCoy make it, amongst African Americans, very active in the civil rights movement, who simply do not see a connection between their struggle, the struggle of black people in this country, and the struggles, as others would have it, of gays and lesbians for or equality that goes all the way to the recognition of their relationships as marriage.
Well, there's certainly a contradiction in the political thought of everyday African Americans. So in research polls, African Americans have high rates of disapproval of the open practice of gay sexuality, but they also show strong support of anti-discrimination policies and a belief in the rights of all minority groups. And I believe that we can explain this contradiction as it relates to the issue of same-sex marriage if we understand what the move from private to public expression of gay sexuality has meant for the black community. So even if you listen to what the Reverend just said, I think you can glean from his comments that part of the issue, the problem here, is this move from gay sexuality as something that is enacted in private settings, but not openly acknowledged and enacted and expected for society to embrace. So I think the contradiction here is in this move, and I think that African Americans as a group are kind of slow to acknowledge this move from private to public expression.
Is there something about African American culture that we're talking about here that is different from the culture of the gay community?
Well, I think that in terms of the civil rights language, civil rights has been a cultural symbol of African American oppression and the movement towards equality for blacks in this country. And so while the definition of what gay rights activists are trying to accomplish technically fits this definition, to use this language when trying to persuade African Americans among one group is perceived by some to be insensitive to the struggles of the racial group. And so I think that gay activists have not learned to respect the cultural practices of other groups. In order to gain a better understanding of what arguments will be persuasive, they need to move beyond talking amongst themselves to people who are not white and who view gay sexuality in certain ways.
Now, Professor, tell me this. In the context of what happened last week in Washington, how important is the church in the black community?
Well, the African-American community, historically, when you look at the black church, it has represented not just a source of spiritual guidance, but it really has been the go-to place for political information, for economic information, for social support. It is the glue that holds the community together. And so even people who aren't regular churchgoers still look to the church and its religious teachings for an understanding of the way to live life. Now, I think that African-American religious leaders are speaking out about this issue because they perceive an attack on a certain way of life, which has been to keep gay sexuality in the private realm. If you look historically at African-American communities, they've always been a central location for African-American gay social life. But it was rarely articulated or shared in public settings, and it was not recognized as part of the larger community narrative of discrimination and struggle. So you even had people who were gay in black churches, but they just weren't practicing openly as gay people, and that was allowed.
Professor Mignon Moore at UCLA. Let me turn to Rick Jacobs, who's a Democratic activist and founder of the Courage Campaign, which is organizing to overturn Proposition 8. Once again, we heard the state court has already been asked to do that. It hasn't made a decision as yet, but Mr. Jacobs is organizing for perhaps another electoral effort. And Rick Jacobs, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Earlier, we heard from Mignon Moore that people who respect gay rights or who are advocating gay rights don't necessarily respect other groups. So when Proposition 8 passed, there were a number of gay activists who blamed the black community because there was a vote against it, or in favor of Prop 8, I should say, and against same-sex marriage among African Americans. Do you agree that gay activists haven't done a good job of trying to understand the non-white objections?
Yes, I do. And I think I want to first thank you for this show. I think it's a very, very thoughtful, sober discussion about a serious issue of human rights, and I appreciate it. And I would also say that
you're saying human rights, not civil rights.
I'm saying human rights. I will read you something though that I'd like to read from Reverend Eric Lee, who is the president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of California, and as you probably know, the SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, is the only organization that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King founded. And he writes the following in his book that's upcoming called Proposition 8, The California Divide. And he says, marriage equality is a civil rights issue. Anytime one group of people is denied the rights of another group of denied the rights another group of people enjoy, it is fundamentally a denial of civil rights. Those are his words, not mine. I think that what you've brought into this discussion today is so important because there are cultural sensitivities. At heart, though, we're talking, I think, about one issue, and that's fear of the unknown. And I think that's really the essence of this. If we take for granted the science that homosexuality is not a choice, then I think a lot of these issues evaporate. They just go away. Now, that doesn't mean that the discussion goes away, and it doesn't mean that those of us who advocate same-sex marriage, marriage equality, have done the best job, because we haven't, in communicating sensitively in a culturally sensitive way. But really what we're talking about is the politics of fear versus the politics of hope and acceptance.
Again, Rick Jacobs with the Courage Campaign. Let me go back to the Reverend Derek McCoy, again, minister at the Hope Christian Church in Beltsville, Maryland. You said earlier, I think, you used the word immutable when you said that the civil rights movement involved African Americans, black people, who were immutably black. Does it change the argument if you concede that the people who are gay or lesbian don't have a choice?
Well, that's a great question. I appreciate that, and I think it's a yes and a no. And let me explain first by saying the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which I do know Reverend Lee there, who was out there talking about the issue of Proposition 8, even though he came out for it, I can tell you one of the original founders and also the past presidents actually came out in an article against that and against Proposition 8 in terms of, he does not think it should be classified as same-sex, it should be a man and a woman defining marriage. So I think what that does, though, just like your other guests have noted, I don't believe it's an issue of fear. I'm not trying to propagate fear. I'm trying to propagate hope and a lot of different things. And I don't think this is one of the major things that our society should look at, because I look at the rudimentary issue of if I was going to war, I really don't care if you're gay or straight. I would want you to make sure you're qualified and you have those kinds of things. I hope that makes some sense. Now, in terms of speaking directly to this issue, one of the things that you got to understand, the black community, and especially in the African-American community in the church, just like one of your previous guests said, it is a mechanism of social change and transformation throughout history. We're dealing with much more than just a simple local church. We're also dealing with the central place where people derive insight, they get political perspective, community strategy, a lot of different things. And one of the things that you got to understand as well is that in the African-American church and the church in general, if somebody is lying, somebody's cheating, somebody's stealing, there are certain rules that we got to, or guidelines I should go by, which is dictated by the scripture. And one of those things, even it does speak about homosexuality, and I'm not one of the people that have brought out that issue over and over, because I do think it is currently a lifestyle choice and even understood by American Psychiatric Institute. But as we look at this moving forward, could it be, that's a hard question to answer a specific yes or no. I think one thing you're going to be clear about is that Scripture is not going to change on the issue. It's going to be very clear, and I think many churches will follow what that mandate is. Anybody that comes from a clergy perspective and saying they can change what that is up to their own thing. I'm not that higher power. That's, as Obama said, that's above my pay grade.
Okay, let me go back to Rick Jacobs. And Rick, let me try to change the direction of the conversation a little bit, if I may, to what it is that you're doing in California. It's my understanding that you're going to Fresno, one of the most conservative parts of the state. The whole Central Valley of California is very much a Republican as opposed to the generally liberal trends in California. Why are you starting your campaign there?
Well, Courage Campaign is doing trainings all over the state, first of all, and we did one in January in Los Angeles. Our second one, based on Camp Obama, which is the self-empowerment story of self-training and 2 days of electoral and community organizing training. Our second one was indeed in Fresno, and as a result of that training, where we had over 200 people from the Central Valley, an idea was born by a wonderful activist named Robin McGeehee up there, and she said, let's all meet in the middle for equality the Saturday after the Supreme Court rules, whichever way it rules. And the reason is that to change the way people think and to change people's understandings, we have to be able to tell stories, human stories, because that's what ultimately changes minds. And so meeting in the middle of the state, which Fresno is almost perfectly geographically, is also meeting in the middle of the country, and it's also a metaphor. We need to have discussions with our neighbors and our friends and our allies, and I use that very, very broadly, because I think even people who may not agree with us are all of those things. And that's what we're going to do on the Saturday after the court rules. And that symbolizes the way the next campaign, whenever that begins, will be run, which is a grassroots, bottom-up campaign, a campaign of empowerment, a campaign of storytelling, and a campaign of hope based on and part of the movement that put Barack Obama into the White House.
Rick Jacobs again with the Courage Campaign. Maggie Gallagher is president of the National Organization for Marriage and a co-author of The Case for Marriage, Why Married People Are Happier, Healthier, and Better Off Financially. And Maggie Gallagher, good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much.
Do you feel that your efforts, obviously not in favor of same-sex marriage, are at the moment on the defensive?
Actually, I know that that's the main messaging point. This is all over. There's been a cultural shift since last November when a red state, a blue state, and a purple state, people all said they want marriage means a man and a woman. But from my limited perspective, what we're seeing is an enormous energizing of the grassroots on this. People are flocking to us. And we're, in one sense, we're overwhelmed, but we're overwhelmed because so many people are asking us for help, so many activists are coming to us, and there's so many opportunities out there. So I'm not pessimistic. I'm energized.
What do you say to the kind of strategy that Rick Jacobs has adopted, this meet in the middle for equality idea? Is there some way that you can specifically counteract that, or are you doing other things?
I think it's a much better strategy than hounding poor Carrie Prejean because she said marriage means a man and a woman, which is what I've been dealing with for the last week. So
she's the beauty queen and Miss California who said she was against same-sex marriage.
She said she thinks marriage means a man and a woman, and she's been under siege ever since. The truth is, I think that's a perfectly appropriate strategy, and we look forward to engaging. And I think the people of California are a little tired. They've now voted twice in 7 years. So if I were a gay marriage activist, I probably would have postponed it. But there's certainly nothing wrong with getting your grassroots together to tell stories about your lives as a way of changing people's minds.
Now, you say twice in 7 years. Earlier, I think it was Reverend McCoy mentioned that there was a Proposition 22. That was succeeded
was
by
eight years.
That was succeeded, of course, by the Supreme Court decision, and that was overturned by Proposition 8. What were the, didn't Proposition 22 pass by a lot more than Proposition 8?
It passed by about around 59 or 60%, and Prop 8 passed by 52%. But we had all the forces against us in that election. We had to get people to vote yes, which is harder, and we had to deal with an establishment. And because of the Supreme Court decision, we had a ballot language that was about eliminating rights. And it was also a big year for Obama, so young people and liberals came out in very large quantities. I'm pretty confident looking at the polling right now that we're probably at 55 or 56% in favor of marriage as a man and a woman in California. And so I think that Rick and others know they've got to change people's minds to win. And, you know, that's the democratic process. I have no complaints. I don't think they're going to succeed.
What about the people who are younger? You mentioned young people coming out for Obama. Among those 18 to 34 years old, 58%, according to CNN, said that same-sex marriages should be legal. Does that mean that it'll be inevitable?
Well, let me just tell you that the exit polls are imperfect. They also said 70% of black people voted against Prop 8, but it was probably more like 62, 63%. And according to Frank Schubert, who managed the campaign, we got about 45% of the young adult votes. And I think one of the things I like about Carrie Prejean is she really does put a... These are people who haven't had a faith. I mean, young people are really intensely propagandized that this is the civil rights movement of the century. I think in the end we do have to win the hearts and minds of the next generation, but not before 2010 in order to win in California. I think we'll hold our 45%, and we might even stick it up to 50% of the young people. I haven't given up on the next generation.
Once again, Maggie Smith is president of the National Organization for Marriage. Andrew Koppelman teaches law at Northwestern University. He's also author of Same-Sex, Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines. Professor, what's the best strategy now for advocates of same-sex marriage?
I think that the most effective political strategy is to keep doing what the movement has been doing and keep the issue salient. One thing that...
put it on the ballot in California next year?
I don't think it's a good idea to put it on the ballot in an off-year election when turnout is low. I want to hear more about why that's a good strategy instead of waiting, public opinion, Maggie Gallagher, to the contrary, notwithstanding, has been steadily shifting in favor of same-sex marriage. And so I think the longer that you wait to bring it to a vote again, the more likely you are to win. But the big triumph for the same-sex marriage movement has been putting the issue on the agenda at all, because it's very difficult to articulate just what bad thing is going to happen if same-sex marriage is recognized, or now that it has been recognized in so many states already, what bad thing has in fact happened in those states. It's clear what good thing has happened, that there are families who are raising children who are recognized by the law and have legal rights that they didn't have before, and those are good for the members of those families. So it's clear what good thing happens if you recognize same-sex marriage. What's the bad thing on the other side?
Well,
I don't think any
of
the guests on this show have articulated that
yet.
Let
me put that to Maggie Gallagher. We've had same-sex marriage now for a while, at least, in Massachusetts, Vermont, and some of the other states. There are people married now in California, and it's apparent that the Supreme Court may say that those marriages have to be recognized, even if they approve Prop 8. What are the what bad things have happened?
Well, let me just say it would be a very bad thing if the California Supreme Court told the people of California they're not allowed to amend their own constitution. That would be a really grave violation of civil rights, in my opinion. But and I don't think the court is going to do it. That's why they're talking about getting it on the ballot. In terms of what are the consequences of same-sex marriage, when you change the definition of marriage...
Wait, what specifically happened in those states where we have
same-sex marriage? First of all, Catholic Charities has been driven out of business because they can't accept the litigation risk of refusing to place children with same-sex couples. Public schools now teach that gay marriage is a great civil right. They teach grade school children that, and parents who have objected have been told by the courts they have no right to object. Their only option is to withdraw from the public schools. We welcome a debate about the consequences of same-sex marriage because the reality is the heart of the gay marriage movement is the belief that you're like a bigot, you're engaging in discrimination if you think marriage means a man and a woman. That's a big new idea. If the government endorses it and the law promotes it, it's going to affect a lot of people.
That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Thanks to Maggie Gallagher of the National Organization for Marriage, Professor Andrew Koppelman at Northwestern, Rick Jacobs of the Courage Campaign, Mignon Moore at UCLA, and the Reverend Derek McCoy in Beltsville, Maryland. In a moment, the cause of the Jesusita fire and the politics of the L.A. City budget cuts on Which Way L.A.? We're on back with Which Way L.A.? They are mopping up now in Santa Barbara County. 13 square miles of fire are now 70% contained thanks to fog and diminishing winds over the weekend. Authorities are asking the public for help in identifying who was clearing brush with power tools on private land. Dennis Bozanich is a spokesperson for Santa Barbara County. And, Dennis, good to have you on our program.
Oh, very good to be with you.
First, let's go over the totals here. How many houses? How many acres? What can you tell us in terms of the grim statistics?
Yeah, the grim statistics are we've had over 8,700 acres burned, though we are not growing that much more. It's given the firefighters the advantage of being able to get to fire lines around 70% of that acreage. Unfortunately, in the middle of that, we've had 77 different homes destroyed, another 20 to 25 damaged, and numerous outbuildings, sheds, pool houses, all kinds of other facilities, barns that were also damaged or destroyed.
Are all the people, 30,000 or so, who have been evacuated now able to go back to their, at least to see what's left of their homes?
We do still have a couple of pockets where folks are been ordered out of their homes. It affects about 145 parcels, and we're estimating about 350 or so individuals who are displaced by mandatory order at this point. Most of the folks were able to return to their homes from the very large, extensive mandatory areas we had up until yesterday. They were able to return yesterday afternoon to their homes. That was the approximately 30,000 that we had over the course of the entire event here, the entire fire. Most of them are back and in place, but we've kept them in a warning area, so we've asked them to stay prepared, be ready to leave again on a moment's notice, or if they feel as though the conditions have changed and they are at risk again.
What has this cost to fight this fire, and perhaps more importantly, how many firefighters were injured and how badly?
You know, at this point, we've had 28 injuries to firefighters. Thankfully, most of them have been minor. We did have, in the early days of some of the toughest firefighting, three Ventura County firefighters who were injured fairly significantly. But we hear good news about them, that they seem to be well on their way to healing, thanks to the folks at the Burn Center in Sherman Oaks there. We continue to, of course, cost all of us a fair amount of money in this. This morning, the estimate that thus far this firefighting effort has cost us $10.8 million.
Now, is that just to the county? Does that include all of the various units that came from other parts of the state?
That includes all of those other units that came. So it's not just a direct impact on us, but through mutual aid, in the state. That was all the different folks who helped us with the fight this week. That's the total up to this point.
It appears now that this is going to be, we're going to see practically a year-long fire seasons in California. With that in mind, tell us more about this request or help from the public in determining who it was that was cutting brush with using power tools. Does it appear that's what caused the blaze?
Well, you know, one of the things that we are asking our citizens for help in identifying anything they may have seen the Tuesday afternoon that the fire started, there were evidently some power tools found used for brush clearing and other brush clearing tools, not necessarily all power tools, but other brush clearing tools that were found in the area where the fire did start. And so we're asking for help in identifying individuals who may have been in that area, and in order to help us determine the cause, what exactly happened that caused this fire to start.
Is the idea with this to take action against those individuals or just to ask them what they were doing?
Well, investigations go where investigations go, Warren, and I think that's going to be, you know, up to those fire investigators to make determinations about whether, you know, they were somehow accidental or anything else. So that's part of the conversation we want to have with them, but it's going to need some help from the citizens to identify those folks. If anybody, they saw anybody in the area, I mean, having that conversation is the first step.
But it sounds as if everybody better be pretty careful using power tools in these kinds of places.
Well, you know, Warren, I grew up, I'm a Southern California native, and, you know, we were always warned, be careful during times of high winds, especially the Santa Anas that are so infamous here in Southern California because of the low humidity and the high fire danger. Well, you know, here we are at basically we would consider the end of the rainy season, and we've had this kind of event very early on in the season. And it just really emphasizes the point you made a moment ago that really fire season is now year-round. We certainly, you know, have seen, you know, drought-like conditions throughout the state, and we just need to be better prepared.
Okay.
and act in a wise fashion year-round.
All right. Well, let us hope more and more people take that seriously because the consequences are extraordinary. Thanks, Dennis Bozanich, very much for being with us.
Well, thanks a lot, Warren.
Acting Public Information Officer, County of Santa Barbara. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
We're Manali back with Which Way LA. The LA City Council is trying to close a $530 million shortfall in a $7 billion budget. Major cuts are expected. The big stuff includes possible layoffs, a reduction in hiring new police officers, closing parks, closing libraries. But some relatively little things are raising political questions. Take the Ethics Commission, created by a vote of the people. Why is it being slashed by almost 18% compared to an average of less than 10% across the board? Jessica Levinson is Director of Political Reform at the Center for Governmental Studies. Jessica Levinson, welcome to our program.
So nice to be with you.
Tell us, first of all, how the commission came to be and what it does.
Well, the commission, as you said, was created by the voters, and the commission is there basically to ensure that there are clean elections. They oversee elected officials. Their primary duties are oversight, enforcement, and education regarding city ethics, campaign finance, and lobbying laws. They're the only city department that gets its mandate from the people. And the commission was created back in 1990, and it came into being with a package of ethical and campaign finance reforms that were passed. And many believe that this permanent ethics commission stands at the heart of those reform efforts.
Now, this is said by comparison to other cities to be a very strong body.
I think that the LA Ethics Commission is a national model. It's worked very well. It's a five-member part-time commission. There's 27 staff members, and it's largely seen as a beacon for the rest of the nation for how well a local ethics commission can work.
Now, how popular is it with the elected officials that it oversees, enforces against, and educates about?
Well, that's a very interesting question. How popular is it among the public officials? Well, the answer is not that popular because a number of sitting public officials have been subject to enforcement actions. The mayor, Jack Weiss, who's now running for city attorney, many people who are sitting on the city council have been subject to investigations and enforcement actions by this commission. So as a result, they are not the most popular group among elected officials, but on the other hand, are actually quite popular among the public, and their duties have only been increased since 1990 when the commission was created.
Jessica Levinson, again, a director of political reform at the Center for Governmental Studies. Rafe Sonnenschein is a political science professor at Cal State Fullerton, author of several books, including The City at Stake, Secession Reform, and the Battle for Los Angeles, had a lot to do with drawing up the current charter of the city of Los Angeles. And Professor Rafe Sonnenschein, always good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
So what do you say when the Ethics Commission is going to be cut by so much more than the other departments? What does that suggest to you?
Well, it really makes you wonder. I mean, when these big budget cuts happen, I always look for the little cuts, because that's where sometimes City Hall gets at agencies they don't like. And if you complain about it, people will say, oh, well, we got to keep the police going and the firefighters going, as if this tiny amount of money is going to keep police officers on the street. I think this is a unpopular body with the elected officials. And my guess is that as a result, people may think that this is a good time to cut them back. I think these voter-approved things, of which there's the neighborhood councils, the Ethics Commission, and even the controller's ability to audit departments, which was a power given by the voters in 1999 with the new charter, very popular with the voters, gives the government a lot of credibility, but not usually too popular at City Hall.
Now, Jessica Levinson, back to you. This hasn't been done yet. There's a long process that is beginning tomorrow when the budget committee of the City Council begins to look at the proposals that have been made. Where did these proposals to cut the Ethics Commission come from?
This week is just the beginning. The City Council will be reviewing the mayor's budget. And where it will be found in the Ethics Commission is that there'll be forced cuts of about 6 permanent filled positions of the commission's 27 staff members. This includes a senior investigator and an educator, both of whom I hear from members of the commission are really key to oversight, enforcement, and education actions. Now, this is a 22% reduction in the commission staff, and 5 of the 6 positions to be eliminated are filled positions. This is important because it's in comparison to positions which are vacant. And some city departments which are going to see cuts will absorb those cuts by eliminating positions that are already vacant. Now, the commission, on the other hand, 83% of their positions eliminated will be from filled positions. This will be a huge and dramatic effect on the commission's ability to perform its duties. Again, the education duties, the oversight, and the enforcement, and it potentially will mean that there will be less investigations, that they will take so long that the statute of limitations will potentially run, so that these actions will never fully be brought to justice. There's issues of cutting services, like information lines. Generally speaking, just less time for education, less time to go through these important enforcement actions.
So, Rafe Sonnenschein, back to you. That might strengthen your suspicion that this might have a little something to do with the fact that the people in charge of drawing up the cuts don't really like what this commission does very much.
Oh, I have a feeling they don't have a lot of friends around City Hall. That would be my guess.
Phil Willen is City Hall reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and Phil, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Put this in the context of all the cuts that have to take place and how serious you think the council and the mayor are about actually reducing services in Los Angeles.
Well, I think it's very serious, and I believe it will happen. I mean, I think that right now the city is facing a budget shortfall next year of $530 million, and no one knows of any real easy, quick fix, either to raise money or cut spending. And I think one thing, especially on the Ethics Commission, what you're talking about, I mean, one reason I think it's getting attacked is because there's really no powerful constituency that comes before the council or the mayor arguing on its behalf. I mean, you have a lot of people, public members of the public that support it, but registered lobbyists, or there's no powerful police union or transportation union that's there making calls to council members or raising money for people's elections to make sure it's not touched. So I think it's a victim of that, basically. But I mean, the another reason why departments like ethics and others are being cut is because again, I mean, we have a shortfall of $530 million. You have the mayor and council hesitant to cut police, and in fact, they want to continue hiring more officers. They're hesitant to cut civilians who work for the police department. They're hesitant to cut the fire department, and they don't want to cut any employees that have jobs that help raise money, whether that be writing parking tickets or doing whatever. So there's not that many options. I mean, the police and fire account for the majority of the discretionary budget for the city of L.A., so that means every other department takes a more significant hit.
So again, then, you think this is liable to happen, unless some constituency comes forward to defend the Ethics Commission? We don't know at the moment who that might be.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of people support it, but again, I mean, do they have a voice at City Hall? I mean, that's the question. And I think there's a couple other things going on as well. Along with this budget shortfall, I mean, we have the city in negotiations with the public employee unions to try to extract concessions from the public employee unions, and that's not going well. That's at a stalemate right now. You also have the fact that the state may be snatching some property tax revenue from the county and cities, and that could mean an extra, you know, losing an extra close to $70 million for the city revenue. So, I mean, the situation is getting worse, not better. So I don't know how you can solve this without major cuts. There are no other honeypots of money out there to dig up.
How much, Jessica Levinson, are we talking about cutting from the Ethics Commission in terms of money?
Well, I think that's exactly the question to ask. The cuts to the Ethics Commission are not actually going to save the city that much money. The cuts would be about $450,000, and that's 0.1% of the city's $4.4 billion budget. Now, I think that the Ethics Commission certainly will see cuts, as every city department will. The issue here is, I think, whether there's a disproportionate impact. And the Ethics Commission is fundamentally a very small group, and there's really, as far as I can see, there's no fat in the commission right now. So when we're talking about cutting the budget of the commission, what we're really talking about, I think it's important to remember, is about 83% of the cuts will be from filled positions. So there's no excess here.
Okay.
And I think that it's important to remember that these cuts will be felt very deeply among members of the commission and will really affect their ability to do their voter-mandated work.
0.1% of the budget, no powerful constituency except the voters who put this into effect in the first place. Another proposal that has raised a firestorm of, another proposal has raised a firestorm of protests. This is the one that would cut the budget of neighborhood councils from $50,000 to as low as $11,200 per year. Dan Dixon of the Northwest San Pedro Neighborhood Council says even floating such an idea is a complete contemptuous show of disrespect. He's quoted in the Daily News in an article by Rick Orloff. And Rick Orloff, good to have you on our program.
Yeah, thank you, Warren. Good to be with you.
Tell us, first of all, what the neighborhood councils do.
The neighborhood councils were created as part of the new charter, and it was originally designed to try and head off the secession movement. But they have now taken on a life of their own. They're advisory bodies in nature, but they have proven themselves to be quite a powerful political influence when they do get organized. They've already stopped the DWP rate hike, and they were very involved in the campaign against Measure B, the solar initiative on the March ballot.
What's happened since it appeared that and was made public that there might be cuts in the neighborhood councils, particularly to City Councilman Greg Smith?
Each council office has been besieged with emails and calls and letters of complaint from the neighborhood council members and their supporters saying, what are you doing to us? $11,200 doesn't even allow us to rent a meeting hall throughout the year for us to hold our meetings. And it completely eliminates their outreach program. And as you were talking about earlier, they do have a constituency that is vocal and knows how to complain.
And they're doing it.
And they're doing it. And in fact, we working on a story for tomorrow's paper, we understand that they pretty much have found a way to restore almost all the money to the neighborhood councils to try and head off the protest when the council meets when the committee meets tomorrow.
So even as we speak, then before the committee even is called into session by Councilman Parks, this may be compromised away.
That's right. And the mayor held a news conference this morning on the gun buyback program, and we asked him about this, and he said that he completely opposes any further cuts beyond what he proposed for the neighborhood councils. And he also has a number of council members with him. Wendy Gruhl, Eric Garcetti, and a number of others are adamantly opposed to making any further cuts for the neighborhood councils.
Let me go back to Ray Sonnenschein again, our political science professor, Cal State Fullerton, one of the people who wrote the charter passed by the voters that created the neighborhood council. Again, how do you view what we're hearing from Rick Orloff as opposed to what we heard about the other commission?
Well, it's very funny because it's almost the reverse. You don't necessarily have an elite consensus around neighborhood councils the way you do with the Ethics Commission, but they've got a mass base. So it's almost a mirror image. And they also have some language in the charter. We never said in the charter how neighborhood councils would be funded, but we clearly made a commitment that either the city or the neighborhood councils should have the resources to allow neighborhood councils to do their work. And they have developed the ability to raise holy hell. I would keep in mind that the mayor's cut was a 10% cut already, and the neighborhood councils had accepted that because it was in line with the other department cuts. And that was a big deal. That's the first time anybody's agreed to cuts in this funding program since 2002 when it started. But then the proposal that came from a couple of council members was to dramatically almost come close to eliminating the money, and that was a bridge too far because people had already agreed to make the cuts. They were not complaining about the 10% cut. They were complaining about going way, way beyond it in a manner that seemed kind of punitive and kind of late in the day and sort of a shot at the neighborhood councils. I think they miscalculated.
Who were those councilmen?
Councilman Parks and Councilman Smith were apparently the two forces in that, although it's becoming rather muddy as people go back over what occurred at the meeting. It's not clear that people really want to take such a strong position now that they've seen the opposition out there. And I think the opposition has gotten a very strong hearing at City Hall. And I think their case is bolstered by having been willing to accept a partial cut along the lines of other parts of the city family. And I think had they been unwilling to do that, I think they would have been seen as utterly unreasonable and not have a leg to stand on.
Rick Orloff, I have here in my hand an announcement, special announcement, it says, from the office of Councilman Greg Smith in response to recent mischaracterizations about neighborhood council funds. It's long and somewhat dense and not always entirely clear, but it's pretty. What the intent of it is pretty clear, is it not? He wants to get out from under this.
Well, completely. And Smith has actually, he's kind of had an on-again, off-again relationship with the neighborhood councils. He's generally supported them, and they like him when he does that. And this is one of the first real breaches, if you can say it, that's the word, with the neighborhood councils. And what he argues is that the city has another $4 million cost this year to run the elections for the neighborhood councils, in addition to the $4.5 million for their budgets. And so it's they are looking to save money wherever they can.
Phil Willen, back to you with the Los Angeles Times, and referring now to the Ethics Commission, 1% of 1%, with Jessica Levinson saying there's no fat in it. Is it conceivable, do you think, that the council could find some way to come up with that $450,000 for that commission or at least have it cut by about the same amount as the other departments?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, it's peanuts compared to the rest of the budget. So I don't know why they couldn't do it if they have the political will.
Jessica Levinson, just a moment ago, Ray Sonnenschein said that the councils have a mass base of support. The Ethics Commission has an elite base of support. But it was put on the ballot and passed by the voters, was it not?
By and large, yes, it was. This is voter-created. Again, it was part of a sweeping, clean government package. And by and large, this is actually quite popular among the public. They continue to add duties to this commission. Now, whether the core group is there to lobby the city council remains to be seen. But while not popular among public officials, as we said, very popular among the public.
So, Ray Sonnenschein, who might come forward on behalf of the Ethics Commission that could be heard by the council in the same way that the people who support the neighborhood councils are?
Well, I think the Ethics Commission needs a little help, more in a sense than the neighborhood councils do, who are perfectly capable of mobilizing. And I actually agree that it's very popular with the public. It just doesn't have the hundreds of people who will automatically be able to be mobilized. But I think there's other folks in town in the sort of civic arena who can really mobilize the popularity of the Ethics Commission on its behalf. And I just think it's a different dynamic than the neighborhood councils. But the popularity is there. It just is going to take more work and more allies to come down there and really make that work.
Rick Orloff with the Daily News. The commission hearings, or the, excuse me, committee hearings of the council begin tomorrow. Are we going to see any argument about this, do you think?
It's going to be an interesting dialogue. The chief legislative analyst is still working on his report, and he will present it to the committee tomorrow afternoon. And there will be several days of hearings. And right now, the full city council is scheduled to get it next Monday.
So, Rafe Sonnenschein, they got a week then. Who would you expect to see come out?
Now, do you mean on the neighborhood council issue?
No, on the Ethics Commission.
On the Ethics Commission, I would expect the League of Women Voters and other civic organizations who, while small in numbers, do have a lot of clout, and all of the sort of ethics community of L.A., which is actually a little bit bigger than you think, not as big maybe as the activist neighborhood council group, but quite influential. And I think you'll see a lot of people out there on their behalf.
All right. We will see what happens. Starting tomorrow at the L.A. City Hall. Rafe Sonnenschein, Cal State Fullerton, The City at Stake, Secession, Reform, and the Battle for Los Angeles. Rick Orloff of the Daily News, Phil Willen with the Los Angeles Times, and Jessica Levinson at the Center for Governmental Studies. Which Way L.A., produced tonight by Francis Anderton and Sonia Geis, our managing producer, Carmen Radziner, technical director, Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way L.A. on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way L.A. is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.